with the 5 minutes are up. And thank you for sticking with us here. We've got one more subcommittee report to hear, and then we're going to have some discussion of the task force as to where we go next. And as I mentioned at the outset, we are hoping, of course, that the three subcommittees will continue to meet. We don't know when the next time the full task force will meet, but we certainly hope that the subcommittees will continue to work on these three areas. So with that, I don't know who's going to go first. Okay, Michelle.
Thank you, Chairman Lanning and members. I hope we don't disappoint you. I'll talk to you in for about 15 minutes. ours is pretty brief. I'm Deborah Schlitt. I'm with the Affirmative Options Coalition. I've been asked to help staff the Asset Development Work Group. And our intent this afternoon is to give you a brief update on how that group is shaping up its work and to share some information out of the research field about what asset property means. So we're the work group. You've heard about helping people make the personal connections in communities, how to get information. Ours is the work group to look at the money issues. How do we make sure people are gathering and securing financial assets to move forward? And we think because Letters Out of Poverty grew out of the Legislative Commission to End Poverty, this is a really important area. The Urban Institute, who did some analysis work for the Legislative Commission on Poverty, in research they did a number of years ago, looked at the issues of asset poverty. And one piece of analysis they did is they looked at households that had been low income and asset poor in 1984, followed up 10 years later to see what had happened. Households that were poor because of low income, 60% had moved out of poverty in that 10-year period. Households that were asset poor, only 40% had moved out of poverty. And that's what we think our group is charged with looking at, is how do we help people gain the means for long-term mobility? And the thought that that economic security is not an outcome of a particular moment or an event in someone's life. That economic security is a lifelong effort, and that's why assets are so important. That it's this lifelong ability to build up a financial cushion, to be able to build up reserves. So Ron is going to talk to you a little bit about what the research says about asset poverty, and then I'll talk again for a couple more minutes about where our group thinks it's taking its work.
Mr. Old.
Mr. Chair, Ron Miller with Legal Aid. First of all, let me congratulate all the members on their re-election. I'd like to...
Well, in this year, every one of the task force members was re-elected.
Well, I was going to make that observation, so I was going to assume then, I think the only thing I can conclude from that is running on the platform of the Ladder Out of Poverty, which is very successful. So, congratulations. What I'd like to do in my brief time is just to sort of take a step back and look at the core question that's driving this whole legislative effort, which is, and our task, our work group, just exactly what do we mean when we're talking about we want to build assets, and I mean, of course, we understand why that goal is important, but I want to get a little behind the obvious. First of all, when we talk about, when we typically talk about poverty, we typically think about income only. However, if we look at income only, that's not only sort of an incorrect measure, it's incomplete. So while they're related, income and assets, they really are distinct. And let me also suggest that the remarks that I have here, or a longer set of the remarks, are in your packets. With there are three differences between what you have in your packets and what you're hearing from me now. One is my remarks are a lot shorter than those. Number two, there are citations associated in your packet with where the sources of information and the statistics and quotes that I'm going to be using are from. And third, this is dramatically larger type, so I can read it.
I can relate to it.
So, as I was saying, so income and assets are related, but they're really, there's an important distinction. And as one research study has noted, incomes are flows of resources. They're what people get in return for their expenditure of labor, capital. Income is spent on the current consumption needs, meeting their needs of the moment. Conversely, assets are, in this author's words, stocks of resources. So rather than income flows of resources, assets stocks of resources. So they're what people accumulate and hold over a period of time, providing for future needs and secure, and most importantly, security against contingencies that are at this point unknown. So, as one person suggested, or one study suggested, these assets are the foundation for well-being, providing personal safety nets to withstand hardship, to create opportunities for advancement, and to secure the future through investments. The Federal Reserve Bank of Boston, actually, said it a different way. Furthering asset development addresses the common needs and aspirations of Americans by rewarding work, promoting initiative and self-reliance, and embodying widely shared beliefs about fairness and opportunity. And again, I'd emphasize, as I have many times, that this is why I think this particular task force is unique and vital and important, because it really, in so many ways, is bipartisan and nonpartisan. It embodies values that we all share, no matter what side of the spectrum we're on, and are to the common good, ultimately, of our citizens, our families, and our state, and our economy. Too many people live in what is termed asset poverty, and I want to have us begin to think of what we're doing in terms of, rather than simply income poverty, I want to talk about asset poverty and start to get that phrase into our lexicon here. Asset poverty is a much larger group. People who live in asset poverty are much larger than the group that lives in income poverty. And that's really important. Because what asset poverty does is measure the family's financial vulnerability to economic shocks. So if one's income is cut off by unemployment, a medical emergency, it's the ability to withstand that and come out the other end and not have to rely on the public systems to get by. And that's the goal, I think, that we're about here, is that. The statistics of asset poverty are even more disturbing, frankly, than income poverty. However, the research on the impacts of asset building are very encouraging. So first, the depressing statistics. And we only have national statistics. Maybe one of the things we'll be able to do through this effort is to, perhaps, we'll look into the ability of trying to bring that down to the Minnesota level. So, 1/5 of American households live in asset poverty, and 1/3 of households with children are in asset poverty. 1/3 in America. That's an astounding statistic. But the research is promising, especially with respect to the effect of asset development strategies on the future well-being of children. A recent study found, for example, that children of low-income but high-saving parents are much more likely to experience upward income mobility, and the same study found that 71% of children born to parents, low-income parents, who are high savers move up from the bottom of the income quartile over in a mere generation. So, it's promising for the future. Another study found that parents with a significant degree of financial assets, there's a positive association between that and the cognitive development of school-age children. I don't think this is something that would be intuitive, but I think these are legitimate research studies. And finally, the research tells us that low-income families who have access to a bank account are far less, and this is intuitive, far less likely to use costly alternative financial service providers such as check cashers, and are much more likely to save and own income-producing assets. So in sum, what we need to do is begin to talk about asset poverty, look at asset poverty as a way to understand the problem we're attempting to address. I think if we can make some positive recommendations to you, and we can work together on this effort, we can make a difference and help more Minnesota families withstand economic hardships and avoid access to costly financial services, which not only impede their ability to get ahead, but in many cases places them further behind. So in sum, which I'm going to flipping through this, I really look forward to the work that this work group is going to do, and ultimately the task force is going to do, to bring concrete recommendations for actions that we can take to reduce asset poverty. So, thank you.
Well, thank you. That's a very helpful analysis. Very helpful. I guess the question I would have is, what's the latest in terms of the whole issue of setting asset limits or having asset limits in order to qualify for various programs? The commission learned about some states that have moved in a direction towards eliminating limits. Mr. Schlick, the information you gave is, I think, pretty important when you say 60% of low income will work their way out, only 40% of low asset will do so. That says something about this issue. What's the latest? What are the trends? What's the latest data show us?
Well, Mr. Chair and members of the task force, Deb is far more conversant with the data than I am, but I can tell you this. In my research and in looking into this, I can tell you that there is the research will show you that people where asset test limits have been eliminated, the outcomes for recipients of public benefit programs are far better. That's just a general conclusion of the research that's out there right now, and we can certainly get you the sites and the particulars. I mean, you know, at this moment, I'll have to take my word for it, but I can assure you that there is sound research with, and the findings are consistent. When asset test limits are removed, people do better in moving out of the system.
Mr. Chair. So I think one of the very first products of our work group will be a charting of what the asset tests are in Minnesota's public assistance programs. We're well along the way, thanks to a colleague of Ron's, Jessica Webster, at Legal Service Advocacy, who's done that. I think the short story about that chart is they tell you that it takes 5 pages to tell you what all the very different asset tests are for different programs and which ones have them and which ones are the same and which ones are different. And so we see in that chart the complexity, and we think that complexity issue speaks also to an initiative that the Department of Human Services, under Commissioner Ludeman's leadership, has initiated around looking at how to simplify and streamline and reduce expensive complexity in our public assistance programs. We think it'll speak to that. And Senator Jungbauer, a piece of homework that we're going to be asking for help from legislative staff, because he's interested in the time different asset tests came into being. I think he's thinking that we'll find that we set limits years ago and froze them that become more and more of a barrier as we go forward. I think the other thing we've seen in the research that builds on what you just heard the last hour from financial literacy folks is that there is research that shows that asset tests, that one of the outcomes when a state relieves asset tests is that asset tests lead low-income households to not bank money because they don't understand, because they're so complex, they don't understand, could this account cause me a problem, could it not have caused me a problem, so that asset dealing with our asset tests may also be a way to meeting some of our goals to increasing the number of low-income Minnesotans who are paying. But I think we can have that to you in the next month or two in sort of complete detail. So the other work we're doing, if that's useful, I can tell you the objective our work group has been given is to identify and develop legislative recommendations to expand opportunities for low-income families to create and build wealth. Our first assignment has been to bring together information like that about asset tests. And we think that there's a framework for our assignment of developing information. One is we are going to look at what practices in the private or the public sector, what in the marketplace and what the government does, erode asset development, and that's probably where the information about asset tests will come in. But what practices in the private sector, the marketplace, or the public sector address access and barriers to savings and actually help develop and create assets. So when we're looking for what we think are model solutions, what our work group has said are the, as we gather information about promising and best practices, our assignment is to find out what are we already doing in Minnesota at what cost, where can outcomes be documented. And by the way, I didn't make mine large type, and I forgot my glasses here at the table, so I'm not as smart as Ron. At what cost are outcomes achieved? Through what funding mechanism are initiatives supported, and at what value? What are promising or best practices inside the state of Minnesota, and what are promising and best practices outside the state of Minnesota that we can learn from? What are the features of what we call mainstream avenues? What are some of the features in our society that allow middle-income families to build and secure assets? What are those features? Do they apply well to low-income households? And are they features that ever lock out low-income households? So we're interested not only in what's targeted at low-income households, but what should be a universal effort, and is it working universally? And then we're also interested in what the components of a successful framework are from a systems point of view, but also from a household point of view. The Wilder Supportive Housing Program has staff participating on our work group. They brought us a really useful grid they use at the front line to walk individual households through asset development. What do they understand about money? Do they have a bank account? Do they have savings? On the transportation grid, are they able to get a driver's license? Can they afford insurance? Do they have a car? Can they afford to repair a car? So each of these assets are on housing, transportation. So we think their grid for the front line is a really useful tool to making our work concrete and moving through that. These sort of ideas that the group has identified wanting to pull information together are what are the consumer protections on the use of credit reports strong enough? Do our public assistance policies encourage or discourage savings? How do we increase the number of Minnesotans who are using banks and mainstream financial products? What are some match saving strategies that make it possible for low-income households to save? The first meeting when you broke us off just at the table, the first time you met, the legislative members of our task force made it clear they're very interested in what could make it possible for more low-income households to buy and repair and maintain automobiles. And that we're also looking at the what would it take to launch a Bank On initiative. 17 local communities around the country have launched this initiative called Bank On. Bank On is in 70, not 17. These initiatives bring financial institutions together, often with municipal leadership, to look at how do you reach the unreached market so far. What practices might the institutions change, what sort of marketing campaign has to happen, and what incentives are put into place to increase the number of people in a community that are using mainstream financial institutions. And we think there's a lot of promise in that in communities in the state of Minnesota that might be interested with some help in pursuing an initiative like that. So that's the work we're hoping to develop. I think the one other piece is that as I was doing some homework in my staff role, I came across a report that's actually a year old. The Pew Charitable Trust convened 5 think tanks, some of them very progressive, some of them very conservative. The Urban Institute, the Brookings Institute, the Heritage Foundation, the American Enterprise Institute, and the New America Foundation. And they asked them to look at the issue of mobility in the United States. And the first report they put out about mobility, where these 5 think tanks along very different parts of the ideological spectrum could agree, was around asset development. And their need, their sort of key statement, we as leading scholars with perspectives spanning the ideological spectrum believe that more can and must be done to make the American dream accessible to all Americans. And they define the American dream as economic mobility. Our shared goal is to improve upward mobility for everyone, with a particular emphasis on lower income Americans, those who face the most difficulty in moving up the income ladder. We're calling for a fundamental shift toward government policies that are mobility enhancing and a more targeted allocation of existing mobility expenditures towards low and moderate income families. So we thought that the work that you've begun here inside Minnesota does have echoes around the country, that there really is, as Ron had spoken, this this place where we think we can find common ground in a public sphere on some strategies that make sense.
Well, it's a good agenda that you outlined there for your group. I think a public policy challenge that we face as legislators in this environment where there's going to be all kinds of pressure to squeeze things down because there isn't the money to do things like have been done in the past. There will be a tendency to both want to make asset limits more strict, more difficult, as well as lowering income limits. And given what you've had to say, it would seem to me that our challenge would be getting our colleagues to understand that focusing on making asset limits even tighter would be a huge mistake. And in fact, we ought to be going the other way. But it's going to be very difficult to resist some income limits. And of course, when you're talking about income limits that are at poverty level, that's another matter. But obviously, we have income limits for various programs that go way beyond the level of poverty. So I see that as a real challenge, getting our colleagues to understand that you ought not to be trying to do both.
And I think most members of our work group share that sense of challenge and understand that some of the assignments we have are going into difficult waters. during the time as the state's trying to solve Medicaid deficits. I think we can provide the information that shows that this is how, this is things like asset tests and asset building are also where economic recovery happens. Because what we're experiencing is an economic crisis caused primarily where the asset market fell apart. And so recovery will require means to make sure that Minnesotans of all income levels can once again start building assets.
Representative Hoffman.
And thank you, Representative Lanning. I just want to make a few comments. One is there's a significant difference between income levels and asset levels.
Right.
I mean, I don't believe we have a culture of dependency within our public income and economic assistance programs. However, when people do come to us for help, we beat them down further into poverty and we require them to spend down and diminish all their assets. And especially in times of the tough economy right now, most of the people coming into our programs are hopefully short-term. But when we make them deplete their assets even further, I think we only encourage greater poverty. And we need to beat back the stereotypes. Just last year, we took away the asset limits for food assistance. And right, not in this room, but a couple floors above, it was said, well, people can drive up to the county offices with a Lexus and now get food supports. And those are the stereotypes we need to beat back and show the evidence that says when we remove asset limits, we actually reduce the dependency and we reduce the longevity that people have on these programs. But it's going to require leadership, and it's going to require us, and it's going to require us to not allow the stereotype to be perpetuated. And I've been a little pessimistic over the last week or so with some of the reports that you've been seeing, and I think only further those stereotypes. But if good policy shouldn't be the victim of good politics. I mean, the very things we're talking about here right now is subject or the victim of some of the best politics of division, and we'll see what happens. But asset limits are very different than income limits, and I want to make sure that we don't confuse the two together.
Well, that was precisely my point, and that's the message that they're communicating to us here as well. And our challenge is to get our colleagues to understand this issue. That's the challenge. And we ought to be working on relieving some asset limits so people can accumulate them assets. If they don't, they're going to continue to live in poverty. And what you've shared with us underscores that. And so that's going to be our challenge. What I was saying is that it's going to be harder to talk against some income limits from going up, and especially income limits that are well in excess of poverty limits. That's going to be a great challenge.
And if I may, it's just really a detail, but when you look at when that chart is done, this 5-page chart of all the details of asset tests and which program is this and doesn't, burial savings, yes or no, I think the place where that income, the low income and the low assets come together in a way that makes you stop and kind of take in a breath is one of the programs, and I can't remember a 5-page chart by heart, so I'm not going to say which one. In which a car is counted as an asset that would make you ineligible unless that car is your home and you're living in the car, then we will exempt it. And that's where the low income limits and the low asset tests come together in ways that remind us of the reality of how we live on this at all.
Any other questions?
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it. And wow, you were way under your hour time frame, so that's impressive as well.
A good point.
Well, I want to take whatever time you wish at this point to any follow-up questions or discussion that anyone has. Is there any burning point that anybody in the audience would like to make that hasn't been made or hasn't been discussed to this point, or there's some information that we should have that we haven't heard yet? Anybody? If not, task force members, what would you like to do next, I guess, is the question.
Mr. Chair, I don't have any suggestions, and I was just curious, I mean, when is the, I was out of town when you had your first meeting and so on.
Yeah.
When are you planning to meet again? Are you thinking like a month or two, or?
Well, we had some discussion before wondering to what extent we could get the full task force to meet during the legislative session. We know that is going to be a challenge unless it would be early in the session before things get busy. That's what we need to be thinking about. As I mentioned, I think we've already told all three groups that we want them to keep meeting and trying to work some more. This was intended today to give the task force a sense of what the discussion has yielded so far, what we've identified as possibilities for our work. And that work needs to continue on a regular basis. We can't afford to wait until after the legislative session to do that. And as I also mentioned earlier, that I'm hoping that there will be some legislative initiatives that come out of this whole discussion that are processed this session and not wait until later. There's no reason why we can't be working on some things that make good sense to this task force. Mr. Ellen, do you have a further?
I just have a suggestion for you. Given the time frame and given where we are and given the whole situation, I might suggest that the task force charge the work groups between now and the beginning of session with trying to develop the short-term recommendations that may be viable for 2011 and submitting those to the chairs of the task force in writing, and then allowing the work groups to continue to meet, because the work groups can certainly meet throughout the session.
Right.
And then, and perhaps, and I would posit that given that period of the legislative session, by the time the task force would gather again in July or whatever, I would believe that there would be a whole lot more flesh on the bones. There'll be a lot more specific and concrete ideas that come out. They'll have been vetting done within the groups, and I think we'd be well positioned then to move forward. So, you know, trying to meld the short term and the long term goals, of which has been articulated by you and Senator Jungbauer, I think we could try to develop some immediate proposals. And I think let the work groups do that and give it to you before session. And that might solve the problem of logistics.
Well, if we were to do that, it probably would be advisable then for the task force to have a meeting very early in the session to just hear what the work groups have suggested by way of interim action. Because I'd hate to see us move forward on specific initiatives unless the whole group has had a chance to weigh in on it. So how does that sound as a possible strategy here?
Mr. Chair, yeah, early January, when you hear back from the three groups, just assuming there's something there that would be worth a meeting, schedule a meeting, yeah, I think January would be a good time.
Okay, well, we'll plan to do that then, and so all three groups keep working, and as we hear from you by the first of the year, we'll determine whether we've got enough for the task force to meet. Ms. Brennan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to say I'll connect with the designated leaders for each of the working groups, and I want to thank each of them for doing so much work today, Pam Johnson and Andrea Persson and Deb Schlitt, for gathering and preparing today. And I'll make sure that I connect with them on a regular basis so that if indeed there is a meeting in January, we've got the agenda set. So we do have meetings set out for 2011. There's one in June. It's all on the website. But we put those in as placeholders just so we all knew that we were going to continue to meet. So I'll refresh those as well.
Okay, if that's agreeable, that's the plan. And again, I want to thank all of you who presented to us. Well done. Lots of good information and good thoughtful presentations. And to all the rest of you, thanks for your continuing interest, and we are now adjourned.